Hello and welcome to Medicine the Truth, one of the four weekly podcasts in our Fixing Healthcare podcast series. I'm Jeremy Corr, host of the popular New Books in Medicine podcast and CEO of Executive Podcast Solutions. With me is Dr. Robert Pearl. For 18 years, Robert led the Permanente Medical Group, the nation's largest physician group. He's a healthcare contributor at Forbes, a best-selling author, and a professor at both the Stanford University School of Medicine and Business. His most recent book, ChatGPT MD, How AI-Empowered Patients and Doctors Can Take Back Control of American Medicine, on the impact of generative AI will have in healthcare, was published this month and is already number one on Amazon's Best New Books list. All profits will be donated to Doctors Without Borders. Information on a broad range of medical topics can be found on his website, robertpearlmd.com. Robbie, listeners are enjoying this blend of the latest in medicine combined with ongoing updates on COVID-19. What's a couple current news stories?
Jeremy, as you know, I'm a believer that the structure of the American healthcare system is a relic of the last century and needs to be transformed in order to effectively address the challenges of the 21st century. More specifically, I'm a proponent of groups of clinicians joining together to maximize collaboration and cooperation and paying them a set annual fee to provide high-quality medical care to defined groups of patients rather than reimbursing them on a piecemeal fee-for-service basis. The experience of the federal government in promoting accountable care organizations, this is what's commonly called ACOs, provides insights into how the system can be best designed and how medical care delivery can optimally be provided. This month, the Congressional Budget Office, and that's a nonpartisan component of Congress, it released a report looking at these issues. What it found was that two factors differentiate which ACOs are most efficient and effective, leading to savings for Medicare. Since ACOs require large numbers of clinicians and involve risk, they depend on a larger entity to organize them. This could be a hospital, insurance company, or an independent physician group. What the report found is that those ACOs led by independent physician groups were superior in terms of performance and outcomes. And the explanation, it was logical. Hospitals have a conflict of interest between filling beds and making care most efficient and effective. In contrast, independent physician-led groups, they can make decisions based solely on what's optimal medical care for patients. Second, the study found that ACOs with a higher percentage of primary care doctors were most effective. Once again, hospitals are likely to include a greater percentage of specialists than primary care clinicians, since it's the specialists that generate the most income for inpatient facilities when they treat fee-for-service patients in addition to their ACO members. In contrast, the surgical and medical specialists who focus on reversing problems once they arise, primary care is most effective at preventing the need for expensive procedures in the first place by better managing chronic diseases, and thereby reducing the likelihood of patients experiencing a heart attack, stroke, or cancer. And since few doctors in hospital ACOs restrict their practice to value-based prepaid medical care, the net impact of having more specialists in the group is financially beneficial for the hospital, even if within the ACO itself, the costs generated are excessive, redundant, or unnecessary. Jeremy, the report encourages greater participation by doctors and accountable care organizations, and I hope this happens.
Can you expand on your comments on the current types of employment of physicians?
Jeremy, I'm happy to do so. A recent report by Avalier provides a clear view of where we are in the United States and the direction the nation is heading. The bottom line is that the traditional independent medical practice, it's becoming less and less common. Already, more than three quarters of US doctors, 77.6% to be exact, are employed by a health system, a hospital, or a corporate entity. And that can include private equity, a health insurer, or a large pharmacy chain. Last year, an additional 8,100 medical practices were acquired by one of these entities, with three in five physician practices now owned by some non-physician entity. At present, UnitedHealthcare This is the nation's largest insurer. It employs 90,000 physicians, around 10% of the entire U.S. physician workforce. Critics point to the intrinsic conflicts of interest that these relationships between insurers and medical care providers can have when it comes to putting the needs of patients first. However, at least so far, there's little evidence of added insurer intervention in the clinical practice of medicine under these arrangements. Most likely, professional pride and physician concern for patients, they override any potential financial conflicts of interest. By contrast to where we are today, in 2012, only a quarter of physicians were employed, with 263,000 additional doctors having become employees over the past 12 years. And we saw this trend accelerate rapidly during the pandemic, when burnout rose to over 60%, and many doctors experienced reduced income due to patient reluctance to come to their offices or schedule elective procedures in hospitals for fear of catching COVID-19. Jeremy, let me ask you, as a patient, are you aware of whether your doctor is independent or employed? And does it matter to you which it is?
Robbie, my current PCP is part of a local health system. It doesn't really matter to me if they're independent or part of a system. And I've been with this PCP for years and I'm happy with them. So it's really, you know, honestly, not something I put much thought into since I've been happy with them and I have a good relationship with them. Robbie, how does this shift in independent practice and employment intersect with the FTC ban on non-compete clauses for workers?
Jeremy, that's a great question, since the two are intimately related. So let's begin with some background for listeners. Last week, the Federal Trade Commission, or FTC, voted to ban non-compete agreements. This ruling will have broad implications for businesses, including for both senior executives and lower income workers, and it'll have an equally massive impact on healthcare as well. The reasons non-compete clauses are so significant in medicine are twofold. First, medical training now extends for most individuals into their 30s. When they finish, they're looking to move somewhere for a job and start a family. On average, they have $200,000 in student debt with high monthly payments. The reality is that they don't have much negotiating leverage. Potential job offers take advantage of this, often making promises they can't keep. What they recognize is that after a year, newly hired doctor won't be willing to begin the whole process of starting clinical practice again if they must move far away and disrupt their family. For this reason, the handcuffs exerted by a non-compete clause prove very effective. And with the passage of every year of practice, the handcuffs become tighter as the personal, financial, and professional costs of starting over grow greater. The second reason, it's hospital greed. As we discussed in our last Medicine of the Truth, increasingly, so-called facility fees are being billed when patients come for an outpatient service that they could get in the community at far lower prices. Let's say you need a mammogram or a treadmill test, and your doctor recommends the radiological or cardiological service at the local hospital. Not only will you receive a bill for the test itself and the radiologist or cardiologist's interpretation, but you'll pay an added premium simply for the fact it was done in a facility owned by the hospital, even if that actual site of care is miles from the inpatient location. For most hospitals, outpatient services now generate as much or even more revenue as inpatient admissions. And the strategy hospitals are now using increasingly is to leverage this opportunity to bill more by buying the practices of all the doctors in the community, which will force patients to pay and their insurers to pay these higher fees for colonoscopy, chemotherapy, cardiac evaluations, and a broad range of other services. Hospital administrators recognize that as they charge higher and higher facility fees, insurers could reach out, try to contact and contract with physicians who might be willing to end their hospital employment contracts and open offices in the community to service patients who are insured. This, of course, would drive down prices for tests and procedures, and it massively would erode hospital profits. Non-competes prevent that from happening. Across the U.S., four states independently outlawed non-compete clauses, with this FTC ban extending that protection to workers in all 50 states. At present, the AMA estimates that between 37% and 45% of physicians are under these restrictive agreements. By eliminating them and fostering competition, the FTC estimates that close to $200 billion would be saved over the next decade. Of course, the day after the ruling was released, legal challenges were filed, including by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, questioning the FTC's ability to impose such a restriction on states. But as is true for most healthcare issues, the stakes are larger than one might initially assume. And here's why. Remember, the FDA doesn't usually have the power to regulate nonprofit entities. Most hospitals in the U.S. fall into this category. Although the FDA included healthcare workers and doctors in its prohibition, the courts could carve out not-for-profit hospitals. As such, the actual impact could seem far less in healthcare than what many presume. But don't be fooled. That doesn't mean that inpatient facilities wouldn't be at even greater risk. The reason is that an area of public policy debate and massive and growing congressional interest has been whether calling hospitals that earn revenue that is far more than what they pay out in direct patient care should be titled nonprofit. And they increasingly are seeing this potentially as a relic of the past and inappropriate today. And as such, if the courts block implementation of this ban in healthcare, Congress may feel compelled not only to restore through legislation, but also to take away this tax-free status from hospitals. And that would expose them to having to pay millions of dollars in taxes annually. Policy experts expect that it's likely to take years for final resolution to be reached. However, unless a court blocks implementation of these new regulations in 120 days, it will go into effect for both existing and new physician employment arrangements, and that will have as its sole exception executives in policymaking positions earning over $151,000 annually.
Rabbi, listeners keep writing to us for follow-up on topics that we discuss on Medicine the Truth. Let's begin with any updates on the new GLP-1 drugs for weight loss.
Jeremy, the biggest new finding was research on the salutary impact of this class of drugs on a common medical problem, and that problem is sleep apnea. This medical issue is a consequence most often of obesity, and it impacts approximately 20 million Americans. When they sleep, their airway collapses, reducing oxygen flow and awakening them. The most common treatment is what's called a CPAP device, with the letters standing for continuous positive airway pressure. This device continuously pumps air under pressure through a patient's nose, keeping their airway expanded and forcing air into their lungs. As you would predict, a high percentage of patients find wearing a tight-fitting mask attached to a machine at night awkward and uncomfortable. Now there's another option using these highly effective GLP-1 weight loss medications. In clinical trials, Eli Lilly says that its drug Zepbound was successful in improving sleep apnea for patients. And according to the company, on average, the patients in their study lost 20% of their weight. As you might predict, shares of Eli Lilly soared after the announcement, while shares of CPAP manufacturers closed down. The thinking is that excessive fat deposited secondary to obesity in the tongue and upper airway of extremely overweight individuals. It blocks the flow of air at night when these people are asleep and their muscles are relaxed. The result is restricted airflow and diminished oxygen to the lung. As a result, for patients, it's not uncommon to experience 30 apneic episodes an hour in moderate to severe cases, resulting in severely disrupted sleep. Although Eli Lilly has yet to publish its findings, it claims that patients enrolled in that clinical trial reduced the frequency of obstruction by 90%. Given the high retail price of these drugs, and as you may remember from previous episodes, that usually exceeds $12,000 a year. And that's in the context of a cost of manufacturing that's estimated to be less than 10% of that number. The huge profit margin for GLP-1 drugs is clear. However, without health insurance coverage, most patients can't afford the medication, so they don't take it. In contrast, with FDA approval and Medicare inclusion coverage, these drugs would become very positive for the manufacturer's bottom line, as insurance would cover it and more people would be using them. Already, heart failure is recognized as a medical justification for prescribing one of these GLP-1 medications. And currently, Medicare excludes drugs as a covered benefit when the indication is solely weight loss. If the data are confirmed following peer review and publication, sleep apnea would expand the medical indications for prescription and coverage of these drugs and potentially result in reimbursement to the company as a fully covered benefit. In the end, the health risks of obesity are clear. Whether given the current prices, expanded coverage is indicated, and whether it's affordable, that's a different question. In the context of the massive difference between the cost of manufacturing the medication and its exorbitant retail price, you might assume that competition would lead to more affordable pricing and thereby end the debate. But that hasn't happened, and I doubt that it will occur voluntarily anytime in the future.
Robbie, listeners also wanted to know how the patient who received the xenograft kidney was doing.
Jeremy, the first patient to receive a genetically modified pig kidney transplant, his name was Richard Slayman, did have a major rejection episode on the eighth day following surgery. But fortunately, his transplant doctors were able to reverse the problem, and he has now gone home from the hospital. As we would predict, the kidney is functioning following the reversal of the rejection process. And this is a very important first step, although rejection remains a major risk for the patient for months ahead. As listeners to Medicine of the Truth know, there are 100,000 Americans on dialysis in need of a kidney transplant with a limited number of organs from humans available annually. End-stage renal disease is a growing problem. In the U.S., according to the National Kidney Foundation, end-stage renal disease affects only 1% of Medicare enrollees, but it accounts for 7% of the total Medicare spending. And that cost, it's now approaching $1 trillion annually. The ability to transplant a kidney from a pig would be a massive advance. But having said that, the risk of dying from organ rejection or experiencing a life-ending threat from the medications that is required to prevent or reverse this immunological process, that still makes this approach very dangerous and limited to otherwise fatal conditions. Extensive research and experimentation will be needed before xenograft transplantation becomes broadly available. However, since this first transplant, a second severely ill patient has received a kidney from a genetically modified pig. In this case, the woman had both kidney and heart failure. 8 days before the transplant, she'd received she had inserted a mechanical heart pump, what's medically called the left ventricular assist device. Because there were severe cardiac problems, she would be very low on the transplant list and never receive a kidney, which is why she was judged appropriate for a xenograft kidney transplant. Of interest to the clinicians listening to this podcast, the second patient also had the pig's thymus gland transplanted. This rarely discussed organ located in the neck of both humans and pigs is involved in the production and maturation of the white blood cells vital to the immune system. The hope is that by including this gland from the pig, that the patient's own immune system would be less likely to reject the kidney. We will have to see. Time will tell.
Robbie, what else is new in healthcare?
Jeremy, a major problem for patients, and in fact for the entire U.S. healthcare system, remains payments that come from drug and device companies going to clinicians that are designed to incentivize them to prescribe the manufacturer's most expensive and highly profitable medications and devices. Although most clinicians don't believe that these gifts, whether in the form of free food or paid participation at meetings, inappropriately influence their decisions, data show that they're highly effective, generating 9 times the revenue for the manufacturers compared to the dollars spent. This problem has been recognized for a decade with the Sunshine Law passed by Congress, intended to make at least these payments visible and hopefully to reduce the clear conflicts of interest. And now a study in JAMA examines what has transpired since this legislation was enacted, and it reinforces the concerns of the past. In total, pharmaceutical and device makers have made 85 million payments to doctors, totaling $12.1 billion over those 10 years, or more than $1 billion a year. During that decade, 6 in 10 physicians were recipients, although for most doctors, the total dollars involved were small and represented free food brought to their offices. However, in some specialties like gastroenterology, the average payment was over $2,000, with some individuals receiving 10 to 50 times more. And in fact, the highest paid group of recipients among orthopedic surgeons received on average $4.8 million each, the most of any specialty. As we've discussed, the American healthcare system, it's broken. It's zigging and zagging like a U-Haul in reverse. The reimbursement methodology underpays clinicians in a broad range of specialties. But then companies offer perks that offset the diminished revenue for doctors. But that produces ever higher total medical costs and leads to even lower reimbursements for clinical services the next year. All of this creates a vicious cycle. In the end, the U.S. spends double what almost every other wealthy country in the world spends, with outcomes that lag all of the other 11 peer nations. Jeremy, this information on potential conflicts of interest, it's readily available online, but I doubt that more than 1% of patients check it when their doctor recommends an expensive medication or procedure. How can we provide greater transparency into this issue? Or do you think doing so wouldn't make any difference in the decisions that patients make and the questions they ask?
Robbie, I would guess this is something that way less than 1% of patients actually look into. And, you know, I'd like to think that based off of my work with you and other clients in healthcare, and other clients in the healthcare space, I'm probably more educated on how to navigate healthcare from the patient perspective than most. And I know that I never looked into it, and I do not personally know anyone that has. The only thing I can think of off the top of my head is if we had a law where physicians had to verbally and in writing disclose any potential conflicts of interest to a patient each time a new drug is prescribed. I think forcing physicians to put this in front of the patient at the time the drug is prescribed would be the perfect opportunity to let the patient ask any relevant questions and then go home and do their own research. Ravi, what's new relative to COVID-19?
Jeremy, there was a very interesting article published in the New England Journal of Medicine on the drug Paxlovid. This is the medication many patients take when they become newly infected with COVID. And in this study, researchers studied individuals, the ones who didn't require hospitalization, and they gauged the impact of this medication on the alleviation of symptoms. Contrary to what most people, which includes me, would have assumed, the drug didn't provide symptomatic relief. The data indicate that in low-risk patients, and these are individuals who don't have a compromised immune system and aren't severely ill from another cause, that taking the drug offers little or no benefit. Phrased differently, for unvaccinated individuals who are at the greatest risk of developing severe disease, the ones who most likely will need hospitalization and die, the medication is helpful, as clinically indicated. But for Americans who have been vaccinated and aren't at elevated danger due to an immune problem, it seems like they'd be just as well off not being prescribed the drug, at least as measured in this study, by the severity of their symptoms that will result.
Robbie, a listener wrote and asked the following. In your new book, ChatGPT MD, You write about the crucial role leadership will play in the implementation of generative AI in medicine. He asked, how effective are financial incentives and how do they work to motivate patients?
Jeremy, as I note in the book, this is one of the most controversial issues in business. In fact, in the entire field of behavioral economics. Of course, there's a wealth of information showing that financial rewards and penalties do impact people's choices. But there's an equally and probably larger set of studies showing that although they result in behavioral change, it isn't usually what was desired. To make this point, I tell the story of a program, a hospital system implemented to make gastroenterologists more productive in terms of the number of colonoscopies that they do per day. And that was by paying an incentive for high productivity. And the result was that the number of cases performed per doctor per day went up. But the cost per patient, rather than declining, it rose as well. The reason was that doctors who encountered a precancerous polyp, rather than resecting it at the time of a screening exam, rescheduled the patient for a second procedure to maximize the incentive dollars received. What we see now is that there's new data that indicate that in healthcare, financial incentives may have less of an impact on patients than we assumed in the past. Publishing in the Annals of Internal Medicine, researchers looked at the use of insulin by patients after various states capped the out-of-pocket dollars that private insurers could charge. The data show that even though insulin became more affordable, the use didn't rise despite evidence that it would be medically beneficial to the patients. After an 18% decrease in how much patients would have to pay, people with type 2 adult onset diabetes who would benefit clinically weren't more likely to begin insulin treatment than before. The interpretation is that the biggest hurdle to overcome in this study wasn't the monthly cost, but instead it was the individual's reluctance to inject themselves compared to continuing to take far less effective pills. The exception was in lower income patients for whom the new $35 out-of-pocket cap made a major financial difference, and it did result in augmented utilization. This new study contradicted previous ones that implied that this level of cost cap would make a clinical difference. The study is a good reminder that contrary to what many people believe, financial incentives rarely produce the outcome that people expect or desired. Skilled leadership, on the other hand, almost always proves more successful than money.
Robbie, as you know, I'm particularly interested in health issues related to children. What do you have this month?
Jeremy, a study published in JAMA Pediatrics looked at the impact of COVID on childhood development. The researchers found that the pandemic had caused, in quotes, modest delays in development. The work from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine of 50,000 patients used data from a web-based screening tool to measure the milestones reached by kids who were between birth and age 5 during the pandemic. And what they found was that compared to what would have been expected, there were small delays in development in this particular age cohort. Communication scores were 3% lower. Problem solving and social skills, they were 2% lower compared to children who were in this age group 3 years prior to the onset of COVID. The authors point out that these lagging skills in communication, social interaction, and problem solving would be the ones most likely to be affected since the ages of birth to 5 years is the time period in which they massively develop and can be best acquired through interaction with other kids. In contrast, skills such as fine and gross motor skills weren't negatively impacted. And that, of course, makes sense because these abilities can be learned in the home, independent of social interactions. Consistent with these findings, the kids most negatively impacted were the older ones, closer in age to 5, rather than the youngest. And the reason is that for most newborns, nearly all of the interactions that they normally have are with family members, which if anything might have actually become more frequent during the pandemic, with work being virtual for many parents. In contrast, in older kids, toddler interactions contribute powerfully when it comes to things like communication and successful development of social skills. Parents often take the process of social development for granted, since it is so embedded in society and it happens seemingly without conscious effort. But when an external force like COVID restricts the type of play, developmental delay results. Researchers will continue to monitor these kids to see whether the delays persist, worsen, or ameliorate. In the same way that language can be best learned when the brain is developing, communication, problem solving, and social skills also have a window that is viewed as optimal. For many kids born during the pandemic, that window might have been at least narrowed, if not closed.
Robbie, in Uncaring, you wrote about pelvic exams and how women in the past were often used for teaching purposes in less than the most ethical ways. Does this still happen?
Jeremy, unfortunately, this still occurs, although in less overt ways that I talked about in the book. Specifically, when women are in the operating room and asleep for one procedure, attending doctors sometimes use the opportunity to let medical students do a pelvic exam for learning purposes. Obviously, this deception is despicable, and it was highlighted in a New York Times investigation report completed in 2020. To stop this practice, the Department of Health and Human Services last week mandated that hospitals must obtain written informed consent for what they label as sensitive examinations. These include pelvic and prostate exams, especially when patients are under anesthesia and can't give verbal consent. The Secretary of Health and Human Services sent a letter to all teaching hospitals and medical schools denouncing this practice. And he clarified that following these guidelines would be a requirement to participate in the Medicare and Medicaid programs, without which almost no hospital in the country could remain financially viable.
Robbie, as your book ChatGPT MD points out, generative AI is becoming more powerful at an exponential rate. How is this impacting doctors?
Jeremy, we're seeing more and more evidence of the reliability of this technology. As an example, in a recent article from the Annals of Emergency Medicine, researchers provided emergency medicine physicians and ChatGPT with actual patient information, including history, physical exam findings, laboratory results, etc. And they found that the generative AI tool was 97% accurate in making the right diagnosis compared to only 87% for the physicians. Having said that, I'll stress a point that we've discussed multiple times in Medicine the Truth. This technology is not yet ready to substitute for humans, even though the data is encouraging about the opportunities in the near future. In parallel, there was a survey of US physicians, and it found that 40% of them were planning to use a generative AI tool in the coming year. And this is a huge increase in acceptance. Of the doctors surveyed, 68% reported having changed their opinion about the technology over the past year, and they think that it will be beneficial in healthcare. More specifically, 81% said it would improve interaction with patients compared to only 3% who said it would not. Over half thought it would save them 20% or more time in their day-to-day practice, and over two-thirds noted that it will allow them to more quickly search the medical literature in the future. As you know, I continue to believe that the use of generative AI will become as routine in medicine as the stethoscope was in the past.
Robbie, last year we talked about the added fees charged by hospitals for medical services that wouldn't usually be billed in the community. Any updates?
Jeremy, what I think you're talking about is what we discussed earlier in the program, which is the billions of dollars that hospitals charge annually when procedures such as colonoscopy, mammogram, or cardiac stress tests are done as an outpatient in association with an inpatient facility. What we've seen is that hospitals increasingly are implying and charging this facility fee for procedures done in outpatient facilities on their campus, and even in doctors' offices in the community, far away from the inpatient care they provide once they've acquired a doctor's practice. Frequently, in addition to higher insurance payments to the hospitals, patients must pay an added out-of-pocket fee since the copayment rates for hospital care and insurance contracts are higher than for outpatient services. Medicare estimates that it spent $6 billion last year for these added costs compared to what it would have spent had patients received the services in the surrounding community, delivered in outpatient facilities and doctor's offices unconnected to a hospital. Although last fall, Congress considered eliminating the higher fees paid to hospitals for the same services as other outpatient facilities, it failed to eliminate the payment differential. And of course, in contrast to the critics of this pay differential, the American Hospital Association says and justifies these fees as needed to offset services like neonatal ICUs, which are very expensive to run and are poorly reimbursed compared to the costs. Jeremy, to me, this method of cost shifting, it makes no sense. And it serves as another example of what's broken in American medicine. If NICUs aren't paid enough, change the fee schedule. Cost shifting rather than solving the problem directly, from my perspective, it just produces perverse incentives and it generates higher costs without added medical benefit.
Robbie, any final thoughts?
Jeremy, as you know, I'm fascinated by human cognitive biases. Often when we think the information we are obtaining is accurate and undistorted, we learn how wrong our assumptions prove to be. In a study from JAMA, researchers looked at 620,000 entries that were made between 2020 and 2022 in what's known as the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. This is a governmental program run by the FDA and CDC that's designed to alert health officials about side effects and complications following vaccination. The expectation is that the incidence of these types of post-vaccination problems, they should be similar on a percentage basis across the country. But when the researchers looked at the data, they were surprised to see that the numbers reflected politics as much or more than science. Specifically, people in states that had voted Republican in the last presidential election, they reported a 25% higher rate of severe adverse events compared to states that had voted Democrat. Of course, we can't be sure whether the higher or lower set of numbers best reflects what patients experienced, but we can be sure that there wasn't a 25% difference in how people responded to the vaccine based on their own biology. Instead, it's clear that political preferences and voting patterns accounted for the discrepancy in the number of severe complications reported by state. Maybe Democrats believed in the value of vaccines so much that they were less likely to perceive or report their post-vaccine experiences as a severe adverse event. Or maybe Republicans overreacted when something happened. But whatever the explanation, unfortunately, the intersection of science and politics in America is growing, and almost always the combination produces distorted conclusions and leads to suboptimal medical decisions.
As a reminder to listeners, this episode is available on our website, fixinghealthcarepodcast.com, and on all podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. If you like the show, please rate it 5 stars and share it with your friends and family. To submit a question or comment to the host, please visit the contact page on our website or send us a message on LinkedIn, Twitter, or Facebook. Thank you for listening to Fixing Healthcare, and have a great day.